Sanctuary of Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Mark Russo.
And I'm Mark Dunley. On the program today, we have Associate Professor Abby Kinchy from the STS Department at RPI talking about citizen science and social actions with Nature Lab Coordinator Kathy High.
Then, David King of the Alt newspaper joins us live in the studio to talk about immigration, ICE's presence in the Capital Region, and some other local topics.
Afterwards, our Melissa Bromley interviews WOOC correspondent Lavanya Mallory, who is traveling to Africa as part of a project sponsored by the charity H2O for Africa Equals Life.
And later on, physicist David Borton joins WOOC correspondent Megan Marin to talk about the high personal and planetary cost of fossil fuels. But first, let's start the show off with some rapid-fire local headlines.
Detroit Record reports that two officers from the Troy Police Department's drug unit were named in a 14-count indictment that was unsealed in Rensselaer County Court on Friday afternoon. Sergeant Ronald Epstein is accused of leading the six-man drug unit on an illegal search of a home at 112 Oakwood Avenue on June 9, 2017. Epstein also allegedly failed to seize the more than one-eighth of an ounce of cocaine discovered during the search. Detective John Comitel Jr. was also charged. Questions arose about a burglary report Epstein allegedly filed in an attempt to cover up entering the home illegally.
Much of the Capital Region is expected to see between 8 and 9 inches of snow starting on Wednesday, slightly down from prior forecasts of a foot. More, however, is expected in eastern Rensselaer County.
The State Assembly on Monday passed its version of the DREAM Act, which provides college financial aid for children of undocumented immigrants. While the Democrat-dominated Assembly has passed the measure regularly, it has only been voted on once in the Republican-controlled state Senate, where in 2014 it was defeated by two votes.
Lobbyist Todd Howe testified in the ongoing corruption trial of Governor Cuomo's former top aide that he found corrupt, that found the corrupt businessman willing to pay bribes to help Joe Percoco cope with financial difficulties. Howe, a close friend of the defendant, said Percoco frequently called the $300,000 in bribe money ZD because he had heard it on HBO's The Sopranos. In addition to getting Prococo's wife a $7,500 a month no-show job in an energy firm, Howe said he arranged for $35,000 in checks to be written to Prococo's wife so the bribes from two real estate developers would not be traced back to Percoco. In return, Howe testified, Percoco worked to clear the way for state permits for a local power plant and help the real estate developers, including getting a series of raises for one of their sons who worked for Cuomo.
A group of unions and progressives rallied at the state capitol in support of a higher state taxes on the wealthy, even as Governor Andrew Cuomo and other state leaders seek to protect wealthy New York residents from higher tax liability due to the loss of deductibility of state and local taxes in the recent Republican tax bill. The groups called for a reinstatement of the stock transfer tax, add in new income tax brackets hidden the wealthy, and closing the carried interest loophole. The state is facing more than a $4 billion deficit, yet the governor has only called for $586 million in revenue actions, including a $140 million levy on health insurers and a $127 million tax on prescription opioids. The Assembly is expected to include some higher taxes on the wealthy in their budget resolutions.
Albany Mayor Kathy Sheehan urged state lawmakers on Tuesday to make last year's extra $12.5 million payment to the city permanent. The $12.5 million is not included in the governor's proposed budget. While Albany receives $128.80 per capita in unrestricted state aid, Buffalo receives $617, Rochester $419, and Syracuse $494. Providing an additional $12.5 million $1,000 would lift the aid per capita for Albany to about $256. Meanwhile, Albany residents and business owners share a disproportionate burden of the city's tax levy, with so much, roughly 64%, of city property being tax exempt.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to WOOC's Hudson Mohawk Magazine on 105.3 FM.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. Next, Kathy High, Nature Lab Coordinator, interviewed Professor Abby Kinchy from RPI about her interest in citizen science and social actions.
I'm recording.
Okay, hi. This evening we have Abby Kinchy, a sociologist working in the interdisciplinary field of science and technology studies. And she's also an associate professor in the SCS department at RPI. Hi, Abby, and thanks for being here.
Hi, Kathy. Thanks so much for having me on the show. I'm excited to be here.
Thanks. Okay, we'll just jump right in. So you have a PhD in sociology and rural sociology. Would you tell us, like, how you became a sociologist, and also what is rural sociology?
I'll try. Yeah, so I really became interested in sociology when I was an undergrad in college and realized that sociology just had these, gave us this ability to look at the rules of society and question them. And I think as a young person, many people are attracted to that kind of critical work. And it was really helpful and liberating to kind of get those intellectual tools to question things about gender and race and class and inequalities. And so then after I was out of school for a while, I decided to go into grad school. And I realized that my passion was around issues around food and agriculture and hunger. And so I discovered that there were these people that were rural sociologists, and rural sociologists focus on people who live in rural places and the social dimensions of agriculture and water and natural resource extraction, and that's where I found myself.
Oh my God, that's great. Where was the degree from?
The University of Wisconsin in Madison.
Oh, cold.
Yeah.
So your past research covers a range of topics, including transgenic crops and fracking. Can you describe some of the research, your research around controversial technologies and things you've learned about controversial technologies?
Sure, I'll try. My research usually examines conflicts in society. And the ways that people who don't have a lot of power, a lot of political power, work together to have an influence and defend things that matter to them, like their land and environmental resources. And there are always new controversies around technology that are emerging that bring about those kinds of conflict situations. So that was certainly the case, has been the case around genetically engineered crops, which are that farmers in many places in the world are not too eager to have and are concerned about how it's going to affect their livelihoods and the control of their seeds. And we see similar kinds of struggles going on today around fracking, oil and gas extraction in places that weren't energy extraction regions in the past. And I'm just drawn to looking at controversies because I think in these moments of conflict, we can often see how those in power hold on to their power and also where the fault lines are and how social movements can often get a foothold to change the way we think about big issues and maybe shift some power a little bit. You asked about some of the things I've learned. I mean, one of the things that I've observed across a lot of different cases is that industry groups and regulatory agencies that are supportive or friendly to industry groups will often try to keep their critics from having a voice by saying that only the opinions of experts matter. This is I've seen this over and over again. And yet, activists sometimes can be successful in changing and challenging that assumption, right? Mm-hmm. So in one case that I spent a lot of time studying in Mexico around the rules for genetically engineered crops, you know, all the rulemakers said, these decisions have to be based on scientific evaluation. Expert panels would come together to evaluate whether genetically engineered corn was a threat. Well, indigenous farmers and campesinos, small-scale farmers, said, well, we care about our corn for a whole bunch of other reasons. they used science, they used citizen science, collaborative community-based science, to support their claims, but they were persistent in arguing that this was not just a matter for experts to decide, but was really up to them as farmers and protectors of maize biodiversity,
right,
to really hang on to their traditional practices. And they were successful in many ways.
Oh, that's a great story. And actually, that leads me into the next question I have. I noticed that you wrote in 2016, you co-authored an article called Citizen Science, Probing the Virtues and Contexts of Participatory Research. Mm-hmm. So with your interest in citizen science practices and participatory research, how are these tools of social movement? And why is it important for people to politically engage in science and technology? You've talked about this a little bit, but maybe you can elaborate on it a little bit more.
That's a good question. I'll try to talk about both parts of it. So first of all, I think it's important to say that there are a lot of varieties of citizen science, right? Citizen science right now is kind of a buzzword in public policy and science funding, and even there's lots of industry, companies that are interested in supporting citizen science. And so when we use that phrase, I think we have to be really thoughtful about what it means and what it means to different groups of people. For social movements, I think citizen science can help to bring wider awareness to an environmental problem. Say if a community is able to take environmental measurements or record their own experiences of illness, that and they're able to communicate that to a wider audience, that can really be powerful in bringing more people in line with a struggle. You can also use citizen science to critique regulatory agencies when they're not doing a good job. And I think participating in a citizen science project can also really help people build solidarity by working together on a project for a long time. But I think it's also important to remember that data alone won't solve problems, right? Just having the science isn't going to magically bring victory to a social movement. And so, we need to think about strategic ways to use citizen science, participatory research practices, to make knowledge that, other groups aren't doing, but also bring that into a larger struggle for social change. But you also asked about why people should think about science and technology or engage in it. I mean, I think that people should engage in discussion and critique of science and technology because they affect our lives in so many ways. And so, if you're a person who's involved in politics and you think about what your elected officials are doing, you should probably also be just as concerned about what scientists and engineers are doing, because the work that they do changes our world just as much as public policy does, but usually without our input and without our ability to vote in different representatives, right? So I think it's really up to us to become science and technology critics and advocates to have a say in how that work is shaped and done.
That's great, and probably now more than ever, right? So how do you see government playing into our food and water and energy safety, speaking of government? And how can we fill in the gaps maybe that government's leaving behind, such as now?
Yeah, I mean, this is such a tough time, right? So we see that the Trump administration is really doing all that it can to roll back environmental regulations, right, to disempower the agencies that are there to do research and to improve our natural resources and protect us from environmental pollution. And so, this is obviously something we need to be paying really close attention to right now. I do think we need much more effective and more democratic regulation of our food, water, and energy systems. And I think that it's not a question of citizen science replacing regulatory science or the work of professional scientists, because I don't think citizen science could ever accomplish the really tremendous amount of research that the EPA and other agencies do on a regular basis. But I think that, social movements and citizen science groups can do so much to shape the priorities of those agencies, and particularly in a moment right now, demand a lot more funding and power to go toward those agencies to focus on the issues that are really of deep concern to all of us.
Yeah, a lot of political action is needed, I think, to encourage people to think about that. So I know that you're also working with a professor in Chile right now around soil remediation, which is a really great project. Can you describe some of the work you both want to accomplish together, both in Chile and possibly here in Troy? What are the plans for that project?
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you asked. So I just submitted a grant proposal for this project. So it's still a very, very preliminary stages. So we will see how it goes. But the idea of this project arose out of conversations with a colleague of mine, Sebastian Ureta, who's in Chile. And he has been doing research over the last few years looking at the Chilean government's attempts to study and remediate soil contamination from the copper industry. And Chile is the world's biggest copper producer and exporter. And it produces a huge amount of pollution, particularly heavy metals in soils. And while there's growing awareness that this causes health problems, there really has been very little effort to remediate those soils. And there's very little public knowledge about it. So there haven't been many successful efforts to communicate the dangers and to help people protect themselves from the risks. So he reached out to me to find out if there might be a possibility to think about citizen science in that situation. So we applied for this grant to bring a postdoctoral researcher to RPI who would sort of take the lead in trying to develop some low-cost and easy-to-use soil testing kits. There are some things like this that already exist in the world, but it's actually not a big area of citizen science right now. There's been much more work developing water testing and air testing techniques. So we're hoping to develop a very easy and useful method that could be used in a lot of different places, including potentially here in North Troy, where heavy metal in soil is also a problem and is a real challenge for gardening and other uses of empty lots in this neighborhood and throughout the city and throughout the United States. So the project would both try to understand people's experiences of soil contamination, the governance context, right? How and why is the government not addressing these issues? Right. How is science understanding these issues? But then trying to work through an interdisciplinary, collaborative project to work with the community to understand soil pollution.
That sounds great, and it's really perfect for a project with Nature Lab. So we would very much look forward to working with you on that.
Really excited about that collaboration.
Yeah, we hope the grant comes through.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. Is there anything else you want to add to this conversation?
No, this has been great. I mean, I just want to say I'm really excited about what's going on at Nature Lab as well, and I think the possibilities for collaboration, interdisciplinary, trans-academic, between academic and community organizations and, social scientists and scientists and artists and community members. It's just very exciting, and this is the kind of stuff that I want to be doing, and I'm glad to be doing it here with you.
Oh, me too. Thank you so much. So that was Dr. Abby Kinji, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
You just heard from arts professor Kathy High interviewing Abby Kinji as part of our Nature Lab series.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM. Up next, we have Luke Naples?
Luke Nathan.
Luke Nathan. Yeah. And David King with the Alt, and they're joining us in the studio for their weekly segment. So, understand there's been some sales going on in Troy this week.
Well, there was one sale at least that we reported this morning. The former Trojan Hotel building where the O'Brien's Pub is currently located was just sold at an auction a couple months ago, but we just confirmed the sale to Darling Properties LLC for $196,000. The LLC is owned by Robert Hirsch, who's a mechanical engineer, well-known sort of downtown business guy. And so we confirmed he was a little cagey, wasn't really prepared to talk about what their plans are for the property at this point. So we're still kind of trying to figure out what's going on there. But that was something exciting that we – just a little story that we cobbled together today. And in other news, the Troy Comprehensive Plan was released today. The Comprehensive Plan is basically the blueprint for the city of Troy for development that will guide – development in Troy for the foreseeable future. And there hasn't been one kind of updated since the 60s. And this current process began like in 2014. The city put out an RFP and hired this private Canadian firm for quite a tidy sum, I think close to, if not exceeding, $1 million, although the bulk of that payment was either grant funded or and some of it also came from a nonprofit, kind of a group of nonprofits in the city. I started to look at it today, but I haven't had a chance to really delve into a lot of the specific recommendations. But I can say that there is a meeting tomorrow night at City Hall at 6 p.m. The Planning Commission is going to begin to review that this big plan.
So by tomorrow night, you mean Wednesday night?
I mean Wednesday night. I apologize.
And is that a meeting where that's open for comments for the public or just to see the plan?
I would imagine there's room for public comment. If not, I think you can at least expect a presentation. But I just, like, on the way over here, I started looking at it. And,
Breaking news.
Yes.
Breaking news. All right.
And then, you know, you have a little bit of competition because at the same time on Wednesday night, 6 p.m., the monthly public forum of the Rensselaer County Legislature is happening, where the public can definitely come and speak at that one. And the minority office, the Democrats in the county legislature, have called on people to come and speak about the 287G program. This is a program that the Rensselaer County Sheriff's Office is planning to enter into an agreement with ICE, Immigrations and Customs Enforcement, a federal agency, in order to deputize four corrections officers at the Rensselaer County Jail, that would basically allow them to act as immigration officials.
So I've heard some about this plan, and I don't know a lot about it. My understanding of it was that part of the reason that the sheriff wanted to enter into this program is it could mean extra money for the county. Is that true?
It seems questionable, and I have to be a little – I have to hedge a little bit because from what we understand, you know, there's been a report from the I'm going to get the name of the NGO wrong, but this group has put out a report that says that this basically entering this program, while it seems to be promising in terms of how much revenue it will bring into the county through maybe increased numbers of inmates, it may end up being costly to municipalities in the long run. But the sheriff has said that has touted it as a way to bring in more revenue for the county, and the county executive, the new county executive, Steve McLaughlin, is also supportive of the plan.
Is that bringing in more revenue because by interning more people, the county gets more money for having more people in jail?
I believe that it's something to that effect, or at least that's a theory. But I think it's disputed as to whether or not it actually does bring any revenue to the county. And then there's also costs of training and things of that nature that may end up tipping the scales one way or the other.
Yeah, I think in Albany, Canada, they actually found that to rent out the prison cells, which they do right now to make money, you didn't have to be in this program. And so Albany County, in fact, decided to back out. But you said there's a forum tomorrow evening. I know my wife and some of her friends had gone to one of the recent forums and testified, but the sheriff was not there. Right. And they've been trying to get the sheriff to show up. So has the county legislature actually succeeded in getting the sheriff to show up and talk?
As far to my knowledge, no. I mean, when I went to that last meeting in December, I had asked the chairman after the meeting, are you going, because quite a few people who spoke said you should ask the sheriff to come and present his plans publicly. And the chairman, who's a Republican, he's now left office, but he told me at the time that they were going to ask the sheriff to come and present his plans. But apparently that's no longer happening. The last story I saw on the local TV news a couple days ago said he has no plans to present publicly to at this time, but that once he entered into the agreement, which I'm, from what I understand, is quite imminent, then he'll put out some kind of memo describing why he decided to enter into the agreement.
And so I believe the sheriff is actually independently elected. So he's not appointed by the county legislature, the county executive. So he's not really accountable to them.
Yeah, I mean, right. There's only so much oversight that they can exercise. And David, maybe you want to talk a little bit about, you had also...
Well, yeah, just to add to that, I mean, the idea of making money off of bringing in more prisoners, I did talk to Sheriff Apple when we learned about both applications by Albany County and Rensselaer County months ago. And Sheriff Apple was very blunt in saying, I applied because I wanted more money. And and then I found out that this was, you know, caused some consternation with my electorate and decided not to go through with it. But I found it, you know, to editorialize a bit here, sort of shocking that a sheriff would straight out say that, look, I wanted more people in my jails because I want more money. I mean, perhaps I shouldn't be shocked, but I think it should be concerning to folks that revenue is tied to locking people up. So even though Sheriff Apple backed away, I think as an elected official, people should still be looking at what kind of values this person has to sort of pursue that.
Yeah, and I mean, just to add to that, you know, an advocate, Joe Pepperone, just wrote an op-ed that was published in the Alt either today or yesterday, and he kind of also highlighted that, you know, the chilling effect that this might have on the immigrant community, just to know that their sheriff has entered into an agreement like this. This would be the first agreement of in a county in New York State to enter into this particular agreement with ICE, and I think that the sort of symbolic... The real and perceived effects kind of entering into this agreement are also kind of an important facet.
I mean, it doesn't – I'm not an immigrant. It gives me the heebie-jeebies to think that the law enforcement in the county is looking to put more people in jail for the purposes of gaining revenue.
Right. And I mean, you know, the sheriff has said that he, you know, they're not going to engage in any sort of sweeps or raids, you know, with this new kind of deputization. But, you know, that's his word. That's what we have.
Well, I know in the past, a couple of times I've been involved in these campaigns, is that we actually fight when the proposal is to build these new jails, because that's exactly what they are doing. They oversize the jails in order to bring in additional revenues. And we're like, we really don't really want more prisoners. And so the idea that you're oversizing the jail and then you're going to be going out and looking for it. But I understand, speaking of jail, wasn't there something going on with the SUNY Board of Trustees and possible conflict of interest?
Well, I don't know about any. I don't know if it rises to the level of jail, but yes, we had a story, I had a story last week about a pretty interesting audit committee meeting of the SUNY Board of Trustees. You know, SUNY is this enormous state public university system. It has 64 campuses, but a lot of people are less familiar with the sort of mosaic of supporting nonprofits that are all affiliated with the university. A lot of them are foundations for like fundraising purposes, and some of them, you know, do kind of housing development, and some of them do.
I remember when I was in college, there was at SUNY Buffalo, there was a smaller area that was owned by a non-campus entity that had a number of restaurants and spaces that were rented to different student groups and some stores and things like that.
Exactly. So, you know, there are many reasons that these exist, but there's depending on how you count them, there could be as many as 200. I got a spreadsheet of it. That's another story. Anyway, at this meeting, the SUNY trustees were kind of alarmed to learn from the top auditor of the university that last year, in 2017, on more than two dozen occasions, the SUNY foundations did business with vendors who were linked to at least one of their board members. And so just on its face, that was kind of a cause for concern. It was, how can, you know, in one example, a construction company owned by a foundation board member won a project through competitive bidding on that campus that foundation was affiliated with. And the auditor explained that all of these transactions were okay. Not only were they legal under nonprofit law, but they were also allowed under sort of SUNY policy guidelines that had been adopted a couple years ago. But this only kind of, to some trustees at least, you know, according to the video of this meeting that I watched, that wasn't enough assurance that, you know, nothing untoward had happened, or at least that nothing that could be perceived as untoward had happened. So...
Yeah. Well, speaking of jail, I believe the director of one of the SUNY nanotechnology groups has in fact been indicted, and I think most people believe he's been doing a lot of underhanded bribery stuff over the years. Is this completely separate?
Yes, perhaps. So SUNY Polytechnic Institute president Elaine Calieros was indicted in late 2016. His trial is in June. He was indicted on federal charges related to alleged bid rigging, which is slightly different, but as you kind of suggest, it is related to the SUNY. He was the director, or he controlled, rather, an affiliated nonprofit with a nonprofit affiliated with SUNY Polytechnic Institute called Fort Schuyler Management Corporation. And that's where all these big state contracts were kind of funneled through. And it's alleged that he kind of, with the vendor, there was kind of extra communications during the bidding process that federal prosecutors say was illegal and amounted to, you know, bid rigging. So I talked to one watchdog named John Kane of Reinvent Albany, and he kind of explained that, you know, especially in light of the charges levied against Elaine Calieros, you would think that SUNY would be extra diligent about kind of trying to avoid these kinds of conflicts of interest as much as possible, and wouldn't be satisfied with simply kind of adhering to guidelines that had been adopted before this scandal kind of came out into the public view.
But apparently they weren't that interested at this point, or
the trustees are, but it remains to be seen, what people say at one committee meeting, you know, who knows whether that all always translates into swift and kind of sweeping action to kind of tighten up.
Well, I guess we only have about 3 minutes left. So speaking of corruption trials, I understand you've been following Mr. Perkoko, who's the governor's top aide and basically on trial for taking no-show jobs for his wife in exchange for power permits and I guess some other type of real estate development. How's that trial going?
It's this week, as you kind of said in your opening segment, is sort of probably the most exciting part of the trial so far, in that Todd Howe, who's the government's cooperating witness, finally has testified. You know, there's been he was a fixer. He was really involved and he had known Joseph Perkoko and Cuomo and Cuomo's father, you know, stretching. This is a long-term relationship. And and he has been testifying about how, you know, there was a good story today in Politico kind of about how the trial has really illustrated how loosely enforced sometimes the rules about lobbying and when to register as a lobbyist, because even though Todd Howe was intimately involved in kind of fixing all these deals and advocating on behalf of people with business before the state, he had never registered as a lobbyist before, ever, or at least not during the pertinent time period. And he even testified that a Cuomo administration official had suggested that he not register as a lobbyist.
Well, one of the things I found struck, I've run a lot of political campaigns, and the idea that Mr. Perkoko was basically still using the governor's, you know, office, official office, while he was running the governor's political reelection campaign, that's really bad. And in fact, many days when he showed up happened to be the same exact days when the governor showed up. I mean, political campaign 101, you do not work out of your government office when you're running a political campaign.
I mean, and what's funny about this is that this came out last year and the year before. This had been reported on, and the trial is just dredging it up. I mean, the governor – we knew the governor was there when Perkoko was working another job, was not supposed to be there. And we also know he was working for Madison Square Garden while he was still doing favors and work for the governor, which brings up all sorts of questions of conflict of interest. And I think what we've seen this campaign do is highlight all these blind spots that the governor says, you know, that shouldn't have – either he was blind to what was going on, or he you know, tolerated it, because this is a man, as you know very well, Mark, has his hands in everything. So it's sort of amazing to see all these violations of ethics.
So when you say he has his hands in everything, he's a micromanager, not yes. That he's having his hand in a candy jar everywhere.
All right. Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. We look forward to seeing you again next week with more interesting local news stories.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right.
Well, for those of you just tuning in, I'm Mark Dunlay.
And I'm Mark Russo. You're listening to Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, Troy.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org.
In our next segment, WOOC correspondent Melissa Bromley speaks to our own Livonia Mallory. Livonia is on her sixth trip to Kenya as part of a project sponsored by the charity H2O for Africa Equals Life.
We have two projects, one in Naharuru, which is a water project. So we're going to survey the land and confirm that it's a good drillable spot for us to drill a drinkable water well. And then we're going a little further west to Kisumu, which is about 8 hours from Nairobi, which is the capital. And there we have an educational initiative. So we'll be going to a school. We'll be interviewing 20 students. And then we will make a determination on whether or not we're going to give away scholarships to pay their tuition, day tuition, which is about 180 U.S. dollars. We have a small grant. And so the grant is committed to funding primarily girls, because what we've learned is if you provide a girl with an education, she values education, and then she encourages her children to get an education. So it affects two generations.
So it's two projects. Mm-hmm. You're helping put make sure that communities have access to clean, safe water.
Correct.
And you're working to help provide young women with education.
Correct.
Yeah. You said $180 for tuition. Is that an annual price?
That's an annual fee with the one school that we've partnered with in Kisumu. So while I'm there, I will tour the school. We'll look at their facilities. We also have books and school supplies with us, so we'll be providing them with some basic school supplies. We're basically going to look to make sure that it's a good school. I have all of my contacts there, and so we've interviewed some of the teachers in advance, and so this school was in the final running. So we're pretty sure this is going to be the project, the school we're going to work with, but I like to be there to see. You know, even though I trust my in-country contacts, I like to see it for myself.
And how did you get started doing this kind of work?
Well, you know, I have a full-time job, as you know, so my job requires that I travel. And one day I was away from home in the hotel, and I normally don't sleep the first night if I'm away from home. So I was up late watching the television, and I saw one of those shows about what's going on in Africa and the lack of clean water and the number of kids that die from drinking contaminated water, which is one child dies every 4 minutes from drinking contaminated water, and the number of kids that desire to go to school and can't. And so it was late, it was probably 2 o'clock in the morning, and I just felt this need that I needed to do something. And first I felt like everybody else, someone else is going to do something, you know, some big corporation is going to do something. And then I realized that it's not other people, it's me. If I believe something needs to be done, then I got to have some skin in the game. And so I was lucky enough to get a $3,000 check from my job. They owed me some money. And so I took that $3,000 and I funded my first water well in partnership with the Peace Corps, which is one of the organizations that we work with. And one well turned into 42 wells. And then I went on a couple of trips with doctors and teachers. And before you know it, I'm going every 2 years. I'm building relationships with teachers there in country. And a lot of the schools are funded by churches. Some people say, well, why do you partner with churches? We partner with churches because they're the ones that are building the clinics. They're the ones that are building the hospitals. They're the ones that are building the schools. And so those are the people that we partner with.
So you're saying churches in Kenya.
In Kenya. And plus churches here partner with those pastors. So we go there and we work with people who want to work with us, who are committed to improving their own community and building sustainability. We don't want to be in the business of just sending money. And that's why we want to educate the girls, because they become the next generation of leaders in that country.
So 42 wells in 6 years?
I started in 2009. when I started. That's when I funded the first water well. So, yeah, 42 wells all over the continent. But we decided to focus in Kenya and Tanzania because they're primarily because they are a Western-leaning country, and people don't understand that. What that means is they want to work with Americans. Countries that are not Western-leaning, they don't necessarily want to work with us. Mm. So we want to partner with countries that have free elections. Democracy is respected in Kenya. Right now, we know they're having problems, but it's one of the few countries in East Africa where there is a democracy. People vote to bring their leaders in, and so we think that's important, too.
Do you know offhand how much money you've raised in order to give girls scholarships and build wells?
Over the years or during this one funding cycle?
Both.
Wow. Well, we've raised, I would say, about $10,000 just for water wells, which is not a lot of money when you think about the corporations that are spending hundreds of thousands and millions of dollars. You know, that's not a lot of money. And it's all coming from individual donors. It's not corporations that are sponsoring this. It's someone saying, here, Livonia, here's $5. Here, Livonia, here's $100. It's individual people, working folks who have jobs like me, you know, not rich people, people who go to work every day and they have rent and they have car payments. But they take a little bit of the extra money they have, which isn't a lot. It could be $20. And they say, here's $20. People don't realize $20 is equivalent to 200 shillings. So that's a lot of money in Kenya. So our money goes a long way. So I say, give me a little and let me do a lot with it.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, $180 for an entire year of tuition for one girl. How much does it cost to build one well?
We try to fund wells between $3,000 and $4,000. We won't go over $20,000 because when you go into the $20,000 and $30,000 range, you need to have a real deep well and you need to have a generator to pull that water up. And most of the Africans don't have the money to buy petrol, which is gasoline, to pull the water. And so we won't do what's called a deep well because we know they won't be able to what? Sustain it over time. So we do shallow wells. A $3,000 well might be a drilled well because the ground is hard, but it might be hand dug as well. Mm. And we know that a bucket well, just like something you see in the country where you lower the bucket down and you pull the bucket up, those last for a lifetime. A hand pump well with a hand crank, they last for a lifetime. If you have solar panels and if you have generators, those parts break. And then the Kenyans can't afford to repair them. They don't have solar panel repair companies there in Kenya. So we stay away from the high-tech wells and go for the old-fashioned hand pump wells because they last for generations.
So you obviously know a lot about this. Did you just learn over time in doing it?
Yeah, that's an understatement. Learn over time. I mean, everything I've done, I've had to teach myself and pull in experts where needed. So I know, I mean, I'm not the sharpest pencil in the box, right? I'm just an average person. So I know if I can do it, anyone can do it. You just have to, you know, I had to learn to do what I do and I had to be an educated consumer. So I had to learn about how to drill a well, even though I'm not drilling it. I had to contract with learners. I had drillers. I had to learn who really knew what they were doing and who really didn't. So yeah, I'm sort of self-taught in all of it. But I take it seriously because I'm responsible for some working mom's $5, and her $5 is important to her. And she's trusting me that I'm going to spend her $5 well. And because it's your $5, I treat it like it's my $5. And people want to be sure that they're giving the money to a good cause and it's going to be used for what you say it's going to be used for. And so that means I need to be an educated consumer in every way. So that's why I go to the schools to actually see the education, meet the teachers, bring books to the library. I mean, it's not uncommon to go to a school in Kenya and walk into their library and they have maybe 50 books. Mm. 50. You go to the Albany Public Library or the Troy Public Library, there are floors of books. You go there, there may be 50 books in that entire school. And the teacher may have the only science book. So what she does, she lectures to the second graders, the third graders, the fourth graders, the high school kids. That's how everyone learns because they can't afford to give you, an individual student, the only geometry book in the entire school. Mm. And so those kids learn just from memorization. And so because of that, they tend to be much brighter, right? Because you have to be pretty bright to remember geometry from memory. I mean, forget it. I mean, I'm still struggling with that new math that the kids are talking about. So geometry, to memorize it, is an impossibility.
It's pretty incredible.
It's incredible. So the kids are really bright. And they have to test into every level of education. Everything is competition. To go to the best school, you compete. You take a national test. And you only go to school if you pass the test and score high and have the money to go. It's not like us in this country. We have free public education. And we talk about our educational system, and it's not everything it should be. And it needs to improve. This is true. Mm. But it's free public education. We Americans gave the world free public education. Before that, everyone paid to go to school. Mm. But here in this country, we created free public education. And it's still a pretty decent education. But you do have to apply yourself if you're going to succeed.
I didn't realize that. So, I mean, this is so impressive. You know, Livonia is here at least once a week helping us make this show happen. And she doesn't talk about this project very much. I think probably the only reason we know it's even happening is because she had to tell us she was going to be out for a few weeks. But for those who are listening and are inspired by what you're saying, how can they help?
The best way to help is to go to our Facebook page. We have a donate button, so click on that button. Give us some $5. We take it. $1, doesn't matter. It's H2O for Africa Equals Life Charities Incorporated. I'm always available by cell phone, 917-400-5055. I can tell you about the projects that are coming up. If you follow us on Facebook, you'll see videos that I'll be downloading. You'll see images from the country. I'll be taking lots of pictures. You'll see girls that we're interviewing. You'll see us passing out the pencils that we receive from donors. People brought, you know, boxes of pencils to my house. People say, what can you do? I said, give me some pencils. So people go to Staples and they buy a box of pencils and they give them to me. People buy socks, they give them to me. Shirts, clothes, books, whatever. I have textbooks from some professors from RPI that I know, from Sage. I will take it all. You know, I'm not shy. I'll take whatever I can put on a plane, and I'm glad to do it.
Is there anything else that maybe I haven't asked you that you think people should know about this?
I think that people need to know that one person can make a difference. It doesn't have to be 1,000 people. You don't have to wait for someone else to be inspired by your vision. If you have something in your heart that you want to do, just do it. You may not succeed the first time, and you will make mistakes, because I've made mistakes. But if the cause is good, then it's good to do.
That was WOOC correspondent Livonia Mallory speaking with her own Melissa Bromley. Up next, physicist David Borton is back with another segment of Equality Under the Law, Practical Physics. This week, he and WOOC correspondent Megan Marone speak about the high personal and planetary cost of fossil fuels.
Well, we were talking about the fact that you use fossil energy, and we're asking you how much you pay for fossil energy.
What is it at the pump these days? $2.40?
Yeah. Call it $2.50. Yeah. Okay, what else do you buy?
I never understand my national grid bill. I buy the gas and my electricity for my home.
Okay, and do you have any idea how much you're paying?
Again, the breakdown is very confusing. What's the average per household?
Well, let's not talk about the average per household. Let's talk about the actual cost of the energy. How is electricity measured? A kilowatt hour is the unit that you buy on your Niagara Mohawk bill.
Oh, okay.
And you know what that costs you?
I'd like to know.
Okay, I don't know. Let's just say 20 cents, plus or minus. Okay, is that a lot or a little?
Well, it seems like a little, but it adds up.
It does.
Yeah.
Okay, now let's talk about natural gas. What is the unit that you buy in natural gas?
Dang, I can't remember.
A therm? What's a therm?
I don't know.
100,000 BTUs.
Okay. Oh, okay.
So that's one of the things about energy. It's all energy, but the people who sell it to you want you to buy gallons of gasoline. Mm-hmm. They want you to buy therms of natural gas. They want you to buy kilowatt hours. Do you know what you're buying?
Apparently not, which is embarrassing. You're purchasing something that you don't know the exact quantification of that commodity.
Right, and it's all energy.
Well, I should speak for myself.
Well, yeah. most people, okay, nerds like me know a little bit more about it. If you had one bill that was energy, and you added up all that you spend for gasoline, all that you spend for electricity, all you spend for natural gas, you look at it and say, energy, why am I spending so much money on energy? Mm-hmm. So that if it's now divided up into all these different forms, then you don't mind going to the gas station and saying, well, here's my gas, and here's my natural gas, and here's my electricity. You got to pay all these things, okay? But if you said, here's my energy bill, and it was all this energy in one bill, you would be surprised.
Yes.
And you might actually do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so pick one. You know, tell me what you think a million BTUs costs. How much energy you buy for a million BTUs?
Oh, I'm going to go down wild speculation avenue and say $500,000.
Yeah, that's surprisingly close for one kind of energy.
What kind is that?
That kind of energy. Have you ever bought a little battery to put in a flashlight?
Yes.
And what did that cost about?
$1 or so?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Right. Okay, now is that expensive or is that cheap?
Seems cheap. Mm-hmm.
But suppose, now I'm going to just run through some numbers here. Suppose you have a 1.5-volt battery and it puts out 2 amp hours. Multiply that together, you get 3.
Okay.
And it takes 300 kilowatt hours to equal a million BTUs.
Wow.
And so if you now multiply this out, it is $100,000 for a million BTUs of electricity when you buy these little batteries. Now, you couldn't afford that if it was anything else. Natural gas is cheap. 40 cents a therm is $4 per million BTUs. You pay $4 for a million BTUs, or you pay $100,000 for a million BTUs. You do both. You buy one of these batteries.
Okay.
You're buying energy at the rate of $100,000 per million BTUs.
Wow.
Those guys have a good thing going for them, right?
Yeah, they do. Yeah.
Okay. Now let's go to gasoline. Okay. Natural gas. Did we just say that that's 40 cents a therm? So $4 for a million BTUs versus...
That's pretty cheap.
Versus $100,000. That's pretty cheap.
Yeah.
Gasoline, we were talking about gasoline. What do you pay for gasoline?
$2.40 at the pump.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So that's equivalent of about $25 for a million BTUs.
Not bad. Compared to the batteries.
Okay. Right. So if you worked for me for a year, remember you were going to work for me for a year?
Okay. Hopefully on the solar boat.
Okay. Well, okay. If I pay you what you're worth in terms of energy, mm-hmm. that would be a million BTUs. So for a year's work, I would pay you... We said that you could put out
a million BTUs
per year.
I work for a year.
Right. Okay. And we said that a million BTUs of gasoline is worth $25.
Right. Okay.
So you work for me for a year and I'll pay you $25.
Oh, that's sad. the saddest story ever.
Okay, so
unless I'm on the Erie Canal and I get a lot of good food.
Okay, that wouldn't even pay for your food, right?
Sad.
Okay, so let's now talk about electricity. Electricity is this really, really good stuff. It's so good that you'll pay $100,000 for a million BTUs when you buy a battery. That's the rate you're paying. So when you buy electricity from natural grid, you're paying approximately $45 for a million BTUs.
No wonder why National Grid will never go out of business. They're just raking it in.
They're raking it in on all these counts. But notice how different those numbers are. $4 for a million BTUs of natural gas,
mm-hmm.
$25 for a million BTUs of gasoline, and $40 for a million BTUs of electricity.
Mm-hmm.
And if you buy one of those little chemical batteries, it's $100,000 for a million BTUs of that. Why would you ever spend that much money on a million BTUs of energy?
People really need batteries, but, you know, if they actually knew the cost breakdown, they right. would have a revolution.
Or they might use rechargeable batteries.
Right. Or that.
Okay, so we've been talking about the relative cost of various kinds of energy, and we have yet to talk about the cost of solar energy, right?
Right.
So maybe we'll do that another time.
Are there any final words for our listeners on what you think? I mean, you've kind of summed up the practical importance of this. I mean, people should know how to break down the cost of resources, right?
Cost has many components, right?
Yes.
Now, if you pollute a river mining coal, we didn't talk about coal, where does that cost come in? What else does coal pollute?
Well, the air,
exactly.
What you're breathing.
There's also something called carbon dioxide.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, is that good for you? Well, in some ways it is. Is it good for the planet?
In a certain amount, but not in the way that we're pushing it in the atmosphere to the magic number 350 that Bill McKibben has made famous as being the number we cannot exceed. And what is that measurement of 350 CO2?
It's parts per million of carbon dioxide in the
atmosphere.
Yeah. So that's another way in which fossil fuels are bad for you, me, and future generations.
Because, wait a minute, we went from coal dust in our lungs to CO2. What's the connection there?
Oh, well, how do you get the energy released from the coal? You've got to, you mine it, and then you have to
light it.
Yeah, burn it. So when you burn it, the coal goes from being carbon to being carbon dioxide.
Okay. And we're releasing, it's just one other way that we're releasing excess carbon dioxide into the atmosphere.
Right. Hmm. All these things are interrelated, and it's really pretty interesting. Energy is a difficult topic because there are lots of different units. We could go into why there are different units. It all comes down to the best thing is solar energy.
That was local scientist, educator, and solar boat builder David Borton and WOOC correspondent Megan Marin with Equality Under the Law, Practical Physics. They were speaking about the high cost of fossil fuel consumption. Stay tuned to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine every Tuesday to catch Dr. Borton and his popular science segments. And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Mark Russo.
And I'm Mark Dunley. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that done through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook pages.
As a reminder, WOOC 105.3 is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org. Or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m., held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.